seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim, alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kazim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام المصيبة للصابر واحدة وللجازع اثنتان.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "The catastrophe is but a single one for the patient man, and two for the anxious one."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, one of the most recommended things in Islam is to supplicate, to do dua, to pray to Allah, to supplicate to Allah, to conduct entreaties to Allah, and to request from the Almighty Allah. In the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that the divinely appointed Imam spoke about the manner in which we should supplicate to Allah. Now, some of us might snicker and say, well, what is there a need to have a formal process of contacting Allah or speaking with Allah or supplicating to Allah? Can't we just do it just the way we want? Well, I give you a very simple example. Before you call somebody, you need to pick up the phone, you need to dial the number, you need to wait for the connection, and then you start to speak, right? Or, for example, if you want to communicate with somebody via a letter, you have to have a piece of paper, you have to have a pen, you have to write it, you have to put it in an envelope, you have to mail it. So, in reality, communication does involve certain formal processes. Now, that does not mean that we can't have a conversation with the Almighty Allah whenever we want. Of course, we can have a conversation whenever we want, but there are certain formalities that should be done. Of course, we are addressing the Almighty Allah, the creator of all of creation. It is no small entity that we are addressing. And what's really beautiful is that Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam doesn't give us pages and chapters and volumes full of formalities that must be done. In this conversation, when talking about the formalities and the manner in which we should supplicate to Allah with one of his companions, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "Whoever supplicates before lauding and praising Allah and calling down blessings upon Muhammad, may Allah bless him and his holy household, is like one who shoots an arrow without a bowstring." Now, of course, if one shoots an arrow without a bowstring, it will not get very far. And so here, directly, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam tells us the formalities of supplicating to Allah, which is something so very simple yet profound. The first is to praise Allah. Alhamdulillah, Subhanallah, Allahu Akbar, or thank you Allah for everything that you have given us. And then after that is to call down blessings upon Muhammad and his holy household, such as saying Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And it is with these two formalities, short, sweet, but incredibly powerful, that our arrow will hit its target and our supplications will reach the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam Al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. In order to get more and more people to have the courage to stand, to rise, we as followers of the Ahlul Bayt have got to take a lead on this under the guidance of the Ahlul Bayt, under the guidance of Imam Al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi. We need to speak more clearly against the injustice. We need to speak more openly about how this injustice needs to come to an end. The people need to rise and overthrow these regimes. We need to be very explicit, very open, using very strong anti-establishment language that Imam Al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi used. He provoked the regime to imprison him and then stood strong in prison. We've got to do the same. Whether we get imprisoned or we don't know what's going to happen. Not all the companions of Imam Al-Kadhim were imprisoned either. Some were, some weren't. But we hope that we resemble Imam Al-Kadhim.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
جوانی داشته باشه ولی استفاده چیه این که انسان وقت خودش رو به فراغت بگذرونه
How can we benefit from our young age? Does it mean to do anything we like? Is it all right to spend all our time for leisure and amusements? As we read in a fragment of Ayah 37 of Surah Al-Fatir, Did we not give you a life long enough that one who is heedful might take admonition. Now, the best age to be heedful of the admonitions of our deeds is before we reach 18.
چقدر بزرگان ما مواظب فرصت‌های خودشون بودن و متأسفانه امروز بد جور فرصت.
Our great elite and scholars were very much concerned about their deeds. Unfortunately, in today's world, many of our chances to grow spiritually are missed. Many talents are ruined in schools, universities, and seminaries all across the Muslim lands. In other words, in comparison to the past generation, we are not producing great graduates from houses or Islamic seminaries and universities. One of the main reasons is that we are not heedful enough about the spiritual life of our young generation before the age of 18. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Hosseini Qumi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en/Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the US, however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive US arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland that are influencing decision makers and policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price. President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not. And they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen, as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the US president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh help promote the US's foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the US president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the US's ironical foreign policy. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the sought deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the US helped end the 2021 war on Gaza, but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the US's $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the US's stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it, and we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that, but it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the US truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda. After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran?
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity. Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline, and he turned the United States from an oil-exporting country into an oil-importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
One of the good achievements of Sheikh Mohammed Taqi Qumi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of Sunni community in the Egypt.
In order to get these different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about differences in branches.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyania. Sheikh Ziyania, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The program, The Teacher, is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam And for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries, cleric, one of the scholars who dedicated his life on establishing dialogue and unity among the Muslim denomination and sects all across the nation of Islam. He is no one but Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Qommi. Sheikh Ziya, in Allah, let's start with you this episode. Give us some information about the early life of Muhammad Taqi Qommi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qommi was born in 1289 according to solar calendar. He was born in 1910.
Yes.
He was born in the city of Qom, and he moved to Tehran when he was very young and studied in elementary school and then in high school in Tehran, and he studied in literature. Besides studying in high school and, you know, learning the Arabic language, French language, and English, he studied in Islamic Studies Seminary. And from that moment on, you know, I think that because he learned three languages beside his mother tongue language, that was Farsi or Persian, this mindset was formed in his mind that taqrib is very important for Muslim Ummah. That's why when he was 27, he moved to Egypt to actualize this idea that letting Muslims sit beside each other and to have them tolerate each other.
That's right.
And be a friend of each other. So Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qommi moved to Egypt. And, you know, the moment that this idea came to his mind and, you know, was strengthened in his mind was the event that took place in Mecca. That was a Shia follower of Islam.
That's right.
Was killed and was executed by a court in Saudi Arabia because he had vomited in Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So, because after this event, the political relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia was, you know, cut. And there were many, you know, tensions between Muslim Ummah.
That's right.
Or amongst Muslim Ummah. So that's why Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qommi moved to Egypt to find a solution for this problem. And this shows that at the age of 27, he had great visions for Muslim Ummah. And this is very important. When you have great visions, you may take great steps.
That's all right.
And he was amongst those people who took great steps for the sake of Islam.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, is it true that it was over there that he was among the founders of Dar al-Taqrib, Bain al-Mazahib al-Islamiyyah, and taking part in the sessions with the other leaders of Islamic denominations over there, isn't it?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is, as it is recorded in the history, in cooperation with Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut and Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. Actually, at that time, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, he was the head of the University Al-Azhar, and after him, Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut succeeded him in being the head of the University of Al-Azhar, and also in cooperation with Mustafa Abdul Razzal, who was the president of Egypt at that time. So this is also a very important point.
Okay.
This is also recorded in the history that, based on some narration, he was invited to Egypt by Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, the head of the University of Al-Azhar, when he realized that this man and this scholar has the tendency of bridging the gaps between the sects. And since the Muslim Ummah at that time was suffering from the conflicts and segregations among themselves, so the head of Al-Azhar University, he was also of this view that this is a good idea to bring all Muslim leader around one table. Why? Because if we spread this ideology of unity among Muslim leader, then from the leaders, it will go down to the followers.
That's right.
So one of the good achievement of Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qommi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of actually Sunni community in the Egypt.
And was it his introduction out of the Shia and Jafari school of thought to our Sunni brother in Al-Azhar that made it official over there. I mean, because of his efforts and his presence. Because for sure, from our Sunni brethren, needed some clarifications and explanations, isn't it? And the best people in order to do so are the Muslim Shia scholars. Muhammad Taqi Qomi for sure was one of them, isn't it?
He was given the chair to teach in Al-Azhar University. And this is interesting that at the moment he was given this chance, and this is also narrated that he was not much confident upon talking about the issue of unity with the vice chancellor of the Al-Azhar University, because, you know, if you are invited somewhere as a visiting professor, so you have to be conservative as much as you can. Why? Because you don't want to lose this opportunity. But for the sake of Islam, for the sake of unity, he talked, as it is narrated in his biography, that the moment I was talking to the head of Al-Azhar and I was bringing up the issue of unity among Muslim sects, I was really nervous. I was not sure if he is going to welcome this view. But interestingly, he welcomed this view, and we see the fruit of this communication is that the moment he was teaching in Al-Azhar, he benefited from that position to establish or to start publishing the journal Al-Islam.
Risalatul Islam.
Yes, Risalatul Islam.
That's right.
And when he comes back to Iran, he talks to Ayatollah Burujerdi, the head of Shia in the world of Islam. And he tells everything about his communication with the leaders of Sunnis in Egypt. And Ayatollah Burujerdi welcomes him with the open arms. And he himself, Ayatollah Burujerdi, he compiles, maybe the thing was ready at that moment, but he compiles an article on the Hadith Ghadir based on Sunni sources.
Yes.
And then this article will be published in where? In Risalatul Islam,
right,
the journal that Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qomi founded in Al-Azhar.
Right.
So from the position that he received in Al-Azhar.
Okay.
So he was trying really hard
right.
to establish this unity among Muslim sects in
That's
Islam.
Right. Thank you very much. Sheikh Zia Inyan, so when we get to the journal of Risalatul Islam, we could see that on different articles, he's explaining his methodology of establishing dialogue among different denominations and sects. Because you give us some of the practical thoughts of Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qomi in order to reach such a goal. What are they?
First of all, we should know that he was believing that for establishment of united Ummah of Islam, there is no way but uniting the culture of Muslim communities and Muslim, you know,
I mean, a kind of cultural unity has to be established, okay?
And this cultural unity cannot be achieved unless you have dialogue and relationships. So in order to get these, you know, different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about and overlooking about the differences in branches.
Yes.
So that's why he says that we need to have cultural unity in order to unite Muslim Ummah regarding the tenets of faith and to forget about the differences that led or direct us toward takfir and, you know, blaming each other.
Yes, very good.
So he believes that Muslim Ummah would not suffer from differences, but Muslim Ummah would suffer from cutting the relationships because of the differences.
Okay.
So he was not in position to reject the differences, but he was in the position of letting people be aware of the differences and also, beside this, be aware of the common points.
That's right.
So that's why he says that Muslims, all, they accept that we have to act in accordance of the sayings of the Holy Prophet.
Right.
So, because we all are agreed on this point, so let us follow it. And we all believe that we have to follow the orders of the Holy Prophet. Some Muslims, they add descendants of the Holy Prophet. Some Muslims, they add the companions of the Holy Prophet. He says, okay, but the Holy Prophet is the pillar.
The pillar.
So us gather around this pillar.
Access, that's right.
And to get benefit from this main pillar.
That's right.
And yeah, you are believing in different, you know, ideas. Mm-hmm. It's respectful, but let others be aware of your reasons, mm-hmm. of your reasoning. Not blame them because of their beliefs. So that's the way that's that he was believing and, you know, also broadcasting his mm-hmm. mindset among Muslim ummah. Alhamdulillah, he was successful.
Alhamdulillah, was successful, and his method was really, I think, practical, a man of action. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Mahtavi?
I think for the final point, I would like to narrate one of his nice saying regarding mm-hmm. the unity among Muslim ummah. He is saying that if we look at two words, Shia and Sunni, mm-hmm. and we give more thought to realize where these two words are coming from and what is the literal meaning of these two words, we will find all Muslims as both Shia and Sunni. How? Because what is the meaning of Shia? Shia means the follower. We have in the Quran in Surah Safat, verse 83, وَإِنَّ مِنْ شِيَتَهِ لَإِبْرَاهِيمِ, we have this word. So he is saying that since all Muslims are loving the progeny of Prophet, you cannot find any Muslim in the west of the world or in the east of the world who does not love the progeny of Prophet. So all of them, they are loving the progeny of the Prophet. So they are following the progeny of
Prophet. They are the
Prophet.
Shia, in fact.
So yes, so they are Shia.
Okay.
And when we look at all Muslims, in terms of action, we see that they are following also the tradition and sunnah
of the Prophet.
So whether or not we are Shia or Sunni, both titles will be applied upon us. Why? Mm-hmm. Because we are loving the progeny of the Prophet and we are acting upon the sunnah of the Prophet. So why we should fight with each other? Why we should only talk or give focus on the differences which will lead to the segregation and actually separation among us?
That's all right. Really, really beautiful sentence from his side. You know,
may God bless him. Yeah.
Yes, there are Muslims all around the world, are both Shias and the Sunnis, following the Prophet and the prophetic lifestyle and the progeny, and also acting according to the
Sunnah
of the Prophet. Really great, I think, as Sheikh said, mindset from both brothers. I mean, from our Sunni brethren on that time at Azhar University, and from a Shia brothers like Muhammad Taqi Qumi in Iran. Yes, 1990, according to the Christian calendar, is the year that this outstanding man passed away in Paris, in France. Of course, there are different, you know, stories and news about his death. Some people might say that he was killed or assassinated. Yes, assassinated or killed. This is not exactly clear. But he was buried, according to his last will and testament, in Imamzade Abdullah in Tehran, today's Shahr Rey. May Allah bless his soul. The late Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qumi, one of the founders of Darul Taghrib Bainul Mazahib al-Islamiyah in Egypt, really an outstanding man who dedicated his life to the proximity between religions and Islamic denominations. Sheikh Mahtavi, thank you very much. And Sheikh Siyainia,
you're most welcome.
It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Iyan Qalb Islam page. Also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Qalb Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Asma, and I have the privilege to be your host for today's discussion. Well, here with me, I have two very dear and credible guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Muzaffar. It's been so long since the last time I met you two, and today I am over pleased to have you both in one picture. Okay, ladies, first I will start with you, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, and alaikum, how are you doing?
Assalam. Thank you so much.
I'm very glad.
I'm doing great, alhamdulillah.
Thank God.
Totally psyched to be here with you guys.
So pleasure to be with you. And you, brother, assalamu alaikum, and how's life?
Wa alaikum salam. Life is good, alhamdulillah. And I'm here after such a long time, and
yes,
great
and
to
it's
be back.
Great to be with you.
Thanks
too.
Thanks for having me.
So, just as the ritual of this program, I would love you two to give me a very short introduction about yourself. And let's start with you, Brother Muzaffar.
Yeah, so I'm Muzaffar Haider. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised in the UK. I'm studying in the Hausa. And now I occasionally show up at IRIB English Radio and discuss some interesting topics with you.
Of course. Yeah. Topics. Of course. And you, sister?
I'm Zainab. I'm a student of philosophy.
Philosophy is very interesting, though. And back to reality, we're talking about complaining. And since it was a very nice and interesting discussion and we couldn't figure it all out, we are having another session considering the complaining. In the previous episode, we talked about the reasons behind complaining. We said that sometimes it comes out of weakness, out of anger. Of course, it would harm the people who are around us. It would make us look like an annoying person and everyone would avoid us. Also, we talked about the fact that we should practice some optimism and we should give up looking at the very dark and gray side of all the stories around us. And now we would like to talk about how to solve it. Are there any cures for complaining? How should we control it? Or are we supposed to change that habit in ourselves?
I'd say immediately yes. Complaining isn't good for your own self. You mm-hmm. know, we discussed how it actually releases stress hormones.
Yeah,
it doesn't. You're doing it to relieve yourself, but
and
actually,
it may lead to depression as well.
Yeah, because you're taking out those parts of your life which aren't working out, or those things which are inconveniencing you, and you're just repeating them. You're doing dhikr of them. Right? Imagine how much effect dhikr has on you. And when you bring all these things out to the surface and others hear them too, it's going to affect them. It's like a cycle. You've just created a cycle now mm-hmm. and it's going to pull everybody in and start making them think negatively as well.
Yeah.
It's like, do you know how they say a smile is contagious?
Exactly.
It's really difficult in today's world to smile at people when you see them in the street. But this is actually from the sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where he would smile at somebody who's walking by. And, you know, for example, it's an act of charity to smile at somebody.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? But we're doing the opposite through complaining. We're spreading this idea of negativity and it's just whirling and whirling around. So we need to get rid of it.
Exactly. Speaking of nowadays, sister, what's your idea about people who were living before us? Do you think they were less complaining? Modern people who are living in this age. I think personally, I would say that maybe people who are living in old ages and they did not have so much of facilities and perhaps they were not